You know, it's interesting. When I teach Joseph, I like to see that first time we saw Joseph with the chaotic family and wearing the robe and all that, that for some reason, at that point, Joseph was kind of whacked, right? He just seemed to be, and he's telling on his brothers, he's not working, you know, there's something that's not right with him. But then at some point in his life, he has that turn, and the Bible does not record when that turn was. The assumption is, you know, as soon as he gets to Potiphar's house, I mean, it says twice in that chapter, the Lord was with him, the Lord was with him. Then when he was in prison, the Lord was with him, the Lord was with him. But there's no specific indication given as to when or why that happened. Maybe it's when he was shuffling off to Egypt and all of a sudden he's on his own for the first time and he doesn't have the comfort of his family that he's all of a sudden relying upon God. Now keep in mind, the Bible also gives us other examples like this where we don't see that turn, right? So we have in John chapter 3, Jesus is talking to Nicodemus, right? He comes to Nicodemus at night and he's talking to Nicodemus. And then at some point in the next 3 years, Nicodemus becomes a follower of Jesus, but there's no recording of when that is or why that is. We just see 3 years later, Nicodemus is there helping to take Jesus' body down and is a follower of Jesus kind of in secret in a sense. And so I give that as an example, is that we don't have that specific indication of when, which I like that because that's also some of our stories as well. Some of our stories are very specific and concrete, right? It was this day, this moment, I heard this sermon, and that's when I gave my life to Christ, and that's wonderful. But then there's other parts of our stories as well where we can't necessarily point to a specific time. It's maybe a 2 or 3 year period, and all of a sudden we just know that we're there now without actually pinpointing a specific date and time. And that's how it is with Joseph. I don't know if that answers or not, but that's a great question. Great question. Yeah, other thoughts, other... Yes. Yeah. Two dreams. So the question is, there's that theme of two that's woven through, and the answer is why? Man, I have no idea what the answer is to that question. No. Numbers in the Bible are a unique thing. Sometimes numbers in the Bible are loaded with imagery and power. Jesus chooses 12 followers. That's to correlate to the 12 tribes and some of those types of things. 40 is one of those numbers, right? 40 years in the wilderness, rain for 40 days. Jesus was tempted for 40 days in the wilderness. And so sometimes numbers like that. Other times we have numbers in the Bible and they just have absolutely no spiritual meaning whatsoever, right? After Jesus has came back from the grave, he's fishing with his disciples, and they pull in 153 fish. Well, what's the meaning of that? That means they caught 153 fish, right? And so I don't know then with this if there is something extra there. At least the Bible does not seem to bring out anything more. There is a theme of two woven through Joseph, at least two with the dreams. There's a series of three dreams, two sets of three. But why that is, I don't know. And I don't think the Bible gives us any more indication. So if the Bible's not going to go any further, then we'll just let it ride at that. Is how. It's a possibility that it could be something like that. Again, if the Bible doesn't necessarily speak to that, then I just kind of hold back and say, well, it could be, but it's just it could be. That makes sense. Yeah, that's a great question, though. Good, good, good. Other thoughts? Other questions? I want to wrap up a little bit talking about being a pastor. I've said some things that I don't want you now to go back and tell your pastor these things, right? How pastors can be bitter and negative and critical. The burnout rate is 90%, right? So when you go back and you hopefully are in church on Saturday or Sunday, please don't say, you know, hey, there's only 10% of you that are going to make it to retirement or something like that. That's not what I'm trying to do. Maybe some things are kept here better. The goal of that, and again, I'm just maybe sharing from my own experience, your church might be totally different, and hopefully it is, with a pastor and pastor's wife and family. But I just, if there's anything I can impart is, you know, we want to treat our pastors and their family with the same grace that we want to have received as well. So when our kids are messing up, I don't want somebody coming to me and giving me some guilt. I want someone coming to me and just saying, yeah, I've been there and my kids mess up too, and guess what? We'll walk alongside of this together, and that's how it is, right? Does that make sense? And so when our pastors' families have those struggles and issues, as they all do or will, it's just to give them that same level of grace as well. Please do not give your... This is something that your pastor will thank me for. They do not want to receive another Christian-themed tie. Okay? I'll just throw that out there. A Bible mug that has a coffee mug that has a Bible verse that's really nice. Don't buy it for your pastor, okay? We have 10,000 of them, and that's nice, and we'll never use them or wear them. But we also have other likes and other interests as well. So just throw that one out there. I have so many ties, and you know, oh my word, I never wear them. So okay. But I will say one of the greatest gifts we can give our pastor, outside of grace and things like that, which we all want, really is a gift card. I'm not saying that because I want something right now. What I am saying is a gift card is it because it's time and money, right? And for pastors who have unusual schedules, right? We're working 24/7, we work every weekend, all those types of things. Really, time and money are two things that are really valuable for us. And so I'm just throwing it out there for you as just a great way to encourage your pastor. Just a simple little note of encouragement and a gift card. Say something more than great sermon, something like that, right? That would be nice. I've had many people tell me that's a terrible sermon or something like that as a joke, so thank you. I've heard that joke now 20 times, right? So, okay, that's great. At least you're paying attention. So, okay, well, let's jump in then and let's continue. As we're talking about Joseph today, I'm actually combining two talks, trying to pack them into one. We're talking about two different themes as we wrap up Genesis. We're talking about the theme of forgiveness, so this is powerful for all of us, and then we're talking about how do we leave a legacy, which is also interesting because that's one of the themes of four as we're talking about hitting that 60-year mark and then wanting to be around for the next generation and a generation after that. And so two themes, forgiveness and then leaving a godly legacy is what we're dealing with this morning. Forgiveness, we could probably do a whole week on just the topic of forgiveness, so I am not going to try to talk about it all. We're not going to hit all the points. I'm going to talk about forgiveness from Joseph's perspective and then just give us a few pointers on forgiveness that hopefully will help us. Again, I'm not trying to say everything possible about forgiveness. Forgiveness is a challenging subject to talk about, and here's why. Because all of us have been hurt by somebody else, right? And all of us, if we're honest, have also hurt somebody else. We don't like to think about that second part, but it's true. All of us have been hurt by someone. If we want to be in a relationship, then we're going to have to be vulnerable and transparent, which also means the likelihood of hurt is great. Most people have been hurt by a church at some point in their life. I know that. I've heard enough stories. I know that I have hurt people and our church has hurt people. Right, I used to lead membership class at our church, and I would tell new people coming in, guess what, if you come to Southbrook, I am going to fail you, right? And at some point, you are probably going to fail me, right? So let's just get that on the table. It's just human nature. Our culture is a culture of hurt. It's a culture of abuse and assaults. It seems to continue to increase. All of us have been hurt by somebody. And at the same time, we've all hurt someone else. We've gotten mad and said something that we shouldn't have. Something that we can't necessarily take back. Hopefully we've grown and matured and changed, but all of us at some point have hurt other people. The need for forgiveness is huge, I think, in our culture. We saw just, 2 weeks ago with the shooting in Orlando that left 50 people dead. I saw last weekend when we were all coming up here, Father's Day weekend, I just read the news that there was 59 people shot in the city of Chicago over Father's Day weekend with 13 killed. It's just a tremendous amount of violence that's going in our culture and the tremendously great need for forgiveness. Some of our relationships are in crisis. We have violence and terrorism in our cities. Forgiveness can be one of those things that's a great gift, and it can also be a deep sense of pain that so many of us carry. So this morning, as we dig into Joseph's life, he comes face to face with his family, those brothers that hurt him. And he's also coming to the end of his life. And so that's how we're dealing with these themes of forgiveness and leaving a godly legacy. So let's pause and let's go before the Lord again. Lord, we thank you again for this privilege, Lord, to come here, to come in community, to open your word, to sing songs that talk about you, to spend time with our families and our relatives and our friends, Lord. Lord, we do affirm that every good and great gift comes from you, which means that all of this, Lord, is yours, is from you, and is to be given back to you. And so I pray, Lord, that as we open your word today, that it speaks to us, that it encourages us, that it gives us hope. And pray, Lord, that as we continue on throughout the day, that the songs that we sang, Lord, will resonate in our minds, and we will continue to sing them as we leave here today. And Lord, as we open up your word, may it speak to us, may it help us as we deal with some challenging topics. We ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so we saw yesterday that Joseph hit it big. He hit success. He had everything that he wanted in life. He had all the power. He had all the authority, all the wealth, all the access. He wore the robe, the chains, the chariots, the ring. He had the wife, the two sons. He was second in charge of all of Egypt. Then the famine came in. At this point, it's probably 25 or so, 18 to 20, 22 years maybe after he has left his brothers. He's about to see his brothers again for the first time after a long period of time. So think about what is going through Joseph's mind now. Imagine the possibilities that he has to get revenge on his brothers. This is the stuff of movies. He can even the score with them. Think about the evils that he could inflict upon his brothers when they tried to kill him and then they sold him into slavery. He could deny them food. He could sell them into slavery. He can throw them into prison. He can chain them to a wall and make them watch an endless loop of Chicago Bears football. It's horrible what he could do to them. Imagine what is going through his mind. Actually, let's open up our Bibles and look, and we'll see for ourselves. We're in Genesis chapter 42 this morning. And in Genesis chapter 42, the famine is now starting to reach, and Joseph's brothers are hey, there's news. Egypt has the food, and so they're showing up into Egypt. And in Genesis chapter 42, we start reading in verse 6. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, the one who sold all the grain to all of its people. And so when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. As soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. I love that little line there, right? Spoke harshly to them. "Where do you come from?" he asked. "Well, we come from the land of Canaan," they replied, "to buy food." Verse 8. Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Then he remembered his dreams about them and said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see where our land is unprotected." "No, no, my lord," they answered. "Your servants have come to buy food. We are all the sons of one man. Your servants are honest men." There's that word, honest. Oh. Hey, we're honest, guys. We're not spies. Verse 12. "No," he said to them, "you have come to see where our land is unprotected." Verse 13, but they replied, "Your servants were 12 brothers, the sons of one man, who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, and one is no more." Verse 14, Joseph said to them, "It is just as I told you. You are spies, and now, and this is how you will be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of your number to get your brother. The rest of you will be kept in prison so that your word may be tested to see if you are telling the truth. If you are not, then as surely as Pharaoh lives, you are spies." And he put them all in the custody, in custody for 3 days. We're at verse 18. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men," oh, you said you were, "let one of your brothers stay here in prison while the rest of you go back and take grain to your starving household. But you must bring your youngest brother to me so that your words may be verified and that you may not die." This they proceeded to do. Okay, so interesting things going on here. It's a little bit different aspect of Joseph, right? We see a little bit of anger, seeing a little bit of vindictiveness here maybe, a little bit of blasting the brothers, if you will. Notice in verse 6, when the brothers come to him, immediately they are bowing down, and Joseph is remembering the dreams. Oh yeah, that's right. From way back when I was a kid wearing the robe, the family was bowing down to me. It says in verse 8 that the brothers did not recognize Joseph. Which makes sense, right? The last time they saw him was 22, 23, 25 years ago. Now he's big, he's strong, he's bald, he's got all the robes, he's speaking a totally different language. He has, you know, they have no clue who he is. They thought he was dead. He looks Egyptian, he's a powerful leader, he has an Egyptian name. It says in verse 9, there's a word that was repeated. At the end of verse 9, we have the word unprotected. And again in verse 12, we have the word unprotected. It's actually the same word that we saw back in chapter 37. It's the same word naked. When Joseph's brothers took the robe and left him naked in the pit, It's the exact same word that was used back in chapter 37 to describe Joseph. Joseph now is accusing them of coming here wanting to strip the land, wanting to take something again that does not belong to them. It's a link that Joseph does that maybe the brothers don't understand, but it's an allusion back to when they took the robe and threw him in the pit. Notice that there's a reversal of action that is going on here. Now Joseph is treating them harshly. Hey, you are spies. No, we're not. We're honest people. Though one of our brother is no more, verse 13. Verse 17 is actually the central verse of the text. And he put them all in custody for 3 days. Joseph, what he is doing here is that he is testing them. He's checking in to see about their heart. He wants to see if they are reformed or not. And so he puts them in prison, which again is a reversal of what the brothers did to Joseph by throwing him into the pit. Look at verse 21. The brothers said to one another, "Surely we are being punished because of our brother." Because of our brother. Oh, that's referring to what they did to Joseph way back when. "We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we would not listen. That's why this distress has come upon us." Reuben, one of the older, said, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy? But you wouldn't listen to me. Now we have to give an accounting for his blood." They did not realize that Joseph could understand them since he was using an interpreter. That guilt that they did of throwing their brother into the pit, of wanting to kill him, of selling him into slavery, is still hanging on to those brothers now, 23 years later. It says in verse 21, they remember hearing Joseph begging for his life. That was not something that we saw way back when we studied Joseph, right, on the first day. But here the brothers can remember hearing Joseph calling out to them. Remember, he's just a 17-year-old kid far away from home, never worked a day in his life. And that guilt is still carrying on over and over to them. One of the brothers stayed back. The other brothers were sent home. Joseph secretly puts the money back in their bags. Father Jacob allows for the youngest son to go to Egypt with the other brothers to get food because the famine is great. We can flip over to chapter 43 and we'll just skip over that. You can read chapter 43 on your own. But in chapter 43, the brothers return to Egypt with youngest son Benjamin. They're invited to a big feast. They fear that Joseph is going to set them up for stealing the money that was secretly placed back down into their bags. They're sitting down to eat this massive meal. They're well taken care of, which again is a reversal theme of what the brothers did to Joseph by mistreating him. Now Joseph is pouring out grace upon them. They look, and as they're seated at the dinner table, they're seated by birth order, which is a surprise to them. Well, how would he know who is the oldest and who is the youngest? As we continue on, look at chapter 45. Some time has passed now between all the brothers coming and going and then the father coming back and all these trips, and there's, who knows, months have gone on here. Look at chapter 45, starting in verse 1. "Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants, and he cried out, 'Have everyone leave my presence!' And so there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him, and Pharaoh's household heard about it. Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Is my father still living?' But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified in his presence." Yeah, you better believe they're terrified in his presence, right? Verse 4, "Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'Come close to me.' When they had done so, he said, 'I am your brother Joseph.'" You know, the one you sold into Egypt? Ah, I love that. Little zinger. "And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now there's been a famine in all the land, and for the next 5 years there will not be plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance." Verse 8. "So then it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household and ruler of all Egypt. Now hurry back to my father and say to him, 'This is what your son Joseph says. God has made me lord over all of Egypt. Come down to me, don't delay. You shall live in the region of Goshen and be near me, you and your children and your grandchildren, your flocks and herds, all you have, and I will provide for you there, because 5 years of famine are still to come. Otherwise, you and your household and all who belong to you will become destitute.' And so that internal tension is just massive with Joseph. Finally, the brothers all show up. The Bible shows us that he's not out for revenge. He's not out to get even. I mean, these events were 20, 25 years ago. He has seen the hand of God at work through his life. Notice the sarcasm I pointed out, but I love that verse 4, right? I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into slavery. It's just a little bit of a zing that he's zipping his brothers with there. But as he's revealing himself to his brothers, he says, not once, not twice, but three times. This is all a part of God's plan. God's the one that's done this. You know, you might have sold me into slavery, but God's actually sending me ahead. God is the one in charge. God is the one that is orchestrating all of this that is going on. Now jump over and look at verse 22. To each of them, Joseph gave new clothing, but to Benjamin, he gave 300 shekels of silver and 5 sets of clothing. It's just a minor little thing, but I wanted to point that out. We've been looking at the roll of clothing that is found here. Notice what Joseph does. The Joseph story starts with favoritism because of that special robe and ends with favoritism, with Joseph giving beautiful robes to his brothers. Just an interesting little twist. The family now all returns to Egypt. And in Genesis chapter 50, which we'll see in just a minute, Joseph then finally forgives his brothers. This is a quick, rough overview, but we're talking this morning about forgiveness, and I've got one thing that I'd like you to see, and you see it behind me. I've got these three thoughts here. I just wanted to park on for a few moments, and if you want to write them down, that's great. It'll help you stay awake, all right, move your hand or something like that. So that first one I want to say is we're talking about forgiveness, and this comes to us from Joseph, is that forgiveness is a process. This is extremely important to understand. For Joseph, this started in chapter 42 when he first met them, but doesn't conclude until chapter 50. And in that time of chapter 42 to chapter 50, I mean, it's decades sometimes that goes by. He wasn't ready to forgive his brothers right away at the front end. Right when he first had his brothers come to him, he was not ready to forgive them. He still had to work through the issues of seeing his brothers. And he wasn't ready, and he still did some things with them to kind of test them and to help prove them, to prove who they were. And so from that, I want to tell us that for all of us, forgiveness is a process. Forgiving someone who has hurt us is difficult and is tough and takes time for us. It's messy. We have to work through our own hurts. It takes time for us. It's rarely a clean and direct action for us. Oh, someone has done a massive hurt with me. Now I forgive them, and now everything is fine and moving on. I am here to tell you that if you're wrestling with forgiveness, that is okay. It is a process that we have to work through. So I have a friend, and my friend's young son was assaulted by a neighbor boy. And my friend was a new follower of Jesus. And he told me once, he said, I'm so glad I have Jesus in my life because I probably would have killed that kid and killed his father for what they have done to my friend's son. And he said, you know, as a new follower of Jesus, it's probably not good to kill someone. So, I mean, he's on the right track, right? But my friend was also in a Bible study at our church at the time, and the other guys in that group were telling him, well, you got to forgive, you got to forgive, you got to forgive. And he knew he had to forgive, but he just wasn't ready yet. The pain is still there, the hurt, the anger, the frustration, all those things are still bubbling through him. He knew, he's like, I know I'm going to be there, I'm just not there yet. And my Christian friends were probably doing a disservice by pushing it too fast upon someone. And so I'm here to tell us that we have to forgive. It's a command, we have no option. The Bible tells us we have to do that. But I'm also here to say that it is a process. It's a process that takes time in our life. We're grieving, we're hurting ourselves, we have anger, we have bitterness, we carry guilt for allowing something to happen or something happened to us. And so I just want to encourage us, as we're talking about forgiveness, to realize that it's a process that sometimes takes time. For Joseph, it took a significant period of time between when he saw his brothers and when he finally forgave them. And it's okay for us to be in the process. Does this make sense, my friends? Okay, for three of you, it makes sense. Great. All right. Let's continue on. That second one, you see it there as well. No, I'm sorry. Go back. Forgive and forget. Man, I hear this all the time. Have you heard this, right? How many? I mean, we've all heard. You need to forgive and forget. Sometimes we hear a phrase like this so much that we just assume it's true, or we assume it's biblical, or we assume it's right because we hear it all the time. I think forgiving and forgetting is a terrible thing. And here's why. The memories that we have are gifts from God, okay? So that's number one. Second thing is, are you telling me I'm supposed to forget some horrible tragedy that happened to me? How arrogant of you to tell me that. Why would somebody else assume that I have to be able to forget some horrible thing that happened to myself or a loved one? I mean, it's a terrible burden to place something like that on somebody else. The problem with forgiving and forgetting is, when we hear that phrase, is that then when we're going through our life and we remember that past hurt, we start to beat ourselves up. Oh, I'm not a good Christian. I should be better. Maybe I really haven't forgiven that person. And why do I still remember these things? I'm supposed to be able to forget these things. Our memories are a gift from God. And I have come to find that remembering past hurts can actually be healthy for us, because it can prevent us from falling into the same mistake that we've maybe fallen into in the past. It maybe prevents us from getting with that same type of abusive person that we were with in the past. It maybe prevents us, oh, hey, I've been in this situation before, and I remember how that turned out, and so maybe I'm going to go in a different way moving forward. I'm going to suggest to you that remembering can actually be a very good thing. Now, there's a difference between that past memory controlling us and also just having that past memory just be a part of our life, and I think there is a difference there. Forgiveness does not mean that we forget, but that hurt has lost its grip on me. Forgiveness does not mean that we forget. Forgiveness means that hurt has lost its grip on me. Does this make sense, my friends? I want to encourage us that forgiving and forgetting, when someone says that, there's something better that is out there. I don't think that's wise for us to totally forget. Yes, Joseph named his kids, God has made me forget, right? But every time he says the kid's name, he's also remembering what God has made me forget. Does that make sense? Oh yeah, the hurt, the pain, I mean, all those types of things. That third one there, forgiveness does not mean a restoration of relationship. Someone has hurt us, we know we're supposed to forgive that person, but that doesn't mean we still trust that person, okay? Someone has done a tremendous disservice to us, or some type of abuse or hurt, or has let us down tremendously. Sometimes we feel that if we really forgive that person, then we have to let them back into our life, and we have to go back to how things were. That is not correct at all. You can forgive someone and still not want to have them in your life. You can forgive someone and still not ever trust them again. So many of us have maybe come from abusive relationships. We have forgiven that person, but we no way want that person back in our life. So for me, I grew up a son of a pastor, I mentioned. He was an average pastor, my father, and a terrible father. So he was also a professor at one time. He was a pastor. He was a president of a Christian organization and a college board member. My father was abusive to my mother. Our relationship was distant at best. It was never a healthy relationship after my wife and I were married. My parents got divorced, and then my father died estranged from our family. And I know I had to, at some point in my life, before he died, I needed to forgive him. And I did, and when I felt like I forgave him, I felt like there was that grip that was released on me. But when I forgave him, we still had restraining orders against him. He was still threatening our life. I still had no desire for him to be in our life at all. I was still considered a threat. And so I want to encourage us as well that you can forgive someone, and forgiveness does not mean the relationship is restored, okay? Joseph here is giving us some powerful, and we can talk about forgiveness for a whole week, and so I'm just trying to talk just a little nugget of it, just a few things for us to be able to take home. Joseph, I think, gives us some powerful truth about forgiveness. It's a process. It took time for Joseph. Forgiveness is not about forgetting, okay? Our memories are gifts from God, and our memories can help us prevent us go down that same path that we've been into the past. And forgiveness does not mean you have to restore the relationship. There can be a break there, maybe there should be a break, and you can still forgive that person. Likewise, you can forgive someone that has already died or passed away. Obviously, there's no ability to restore that relationship. Now, as we continue on here, I want to transition into the final section of Joseph and just kind of wrap him up for us. We're nearing the end of Joseph's life, and I want to talk a little bit just about leaving a godly legacy, which I think is something that's important for Joseph and it's important for us. So a few thoughts for all of us on leaving a legacy. And you see them behind me. First of all, when you're talking about leaving a legacy, this talk is for every single person here. Sometimes the assumption is that when we talk about leaving a legacy, this is only applying to older people. And by older people, it's anyone over 43 years of age, right? Isn't the older person. But actually, leaving a legacy is for every single one of us, whether we have children or not, whether we have grandchildren or not, whether we're single or older or young. This is for every single person here. If you are here, then this talk about leaving a legacy is for you. That second one, you see it there. What type of legacy will you leave? Everyone will leave a legacy. Think about that. Everyone will leave a legacy. It's not an if, but what type of legacy will you leave? And depending on what you want your legacy to be, will change what you do here and now. I'm not a big movie fan. I enjoy movies, but I'm not a movie buff. But I was fascinated when the actor Marlon Brando died, right? This was 11 years ago. One of the distinguished actors of the last century, the Godfather movies, On the Waterfront were his big ones. I remember reading the obituary of his life. In the obituary, I don't know if it was New York Times or something like that, it talked about how the fact that there was a dispute about how many children he actually had. And it was kind of up in the air. How many children did he have? And the obituary said, well, there's at least 11 children that we're aware of. 5 children by his 3 wives, 3 children by his Guatemalan housekeeper, 3 from other affairs. And there was a suggestion that there was still another group of 4 or 5 or 6 that were still out there where there was some paternity issues still going on. And I look at this and I said to myself, man, there's a person that was extremely reckless with his personal life. In a sense, this is a legacy of chaos that he is leaving to his children and to his grandchildren. And as I read further, his daughter, one of the daughters, a woman by the name of Cheyenne, she wrote this, "I have come to despise my father for the way he ignored me when I was a child," she said. A few years after saying that, Cheyenne hung herself. Another son, a guy by the name of Christian, pled guilty to involuntary manslaughter and served 5 years in prison. I mean, this is the legacy of this great actor that was heralded as one of the best actors of this last generation. And so what I'm saying is that all of us are going to leave a legacy, but what type of legacy will we leave? And third point, what matters most? What matters most for us to pass along to the next generation? We all want to be remembered, right? People have buildings named after them, which is a great thing, I guess. But really, in 1 or 2 generations, we kind of forget who that person was. Cemeteries are filled with tombstones with the names on there, forgotten by everyone except just remembered by a few select people. I've been preparing this talk on legacy because I'm giving it this coming Sunday at our church on Joseph and legacy. And as I've been thinking about this idea of leaving a legacy now for a few weeks, it occurred to me that the things that I think are my greatest accomplishments mean very little to the people that love me the most. Does that make sense? The things that I feel are some of the greatest accomplishments really mean very little to those who I care about the most. So I have an earned master's degree. Okay, whatever. So the size and the growth of Southbrook, that I can do a decent sermon every once in a while. I mean, those things that I really think about are some of the great things that I have really mean very little to my wife and to my son and to those, my friends that I have. And I think that's probably true for so many of us. Great, you're saleswoman of the year. Great, you're the youngest CEO. So you made partner. That's wonderful. So you have a salary that's double than your parents. Those are all good things and those are great things and there's nothing wrong with those things. But ultimately, those things that we think matter the most mean sometimes very little to those who love us the most. That's why I'm talking about what matters most. And so this leads us again into our man Joseph. Here he is coming to the end of his life. And I think Joseph is going to teach us this. Here's something I would love for you to write down. Joseph is going to teach us this. Don't live your life, live your legacy. Don't live your life, live your legacy. Let's open up. We're at wherever we're at. Let's look at Genesis chapter 50. At the end of the book, it's the very last chapter in the book of Genesis. It's concluding the entire story of Joseph. And at the end here in chapter 50, Joseph is near death. He is about to die. He's going to give his final words. We're going to talk about the legacy that he leaves and what it means for us to leave a godly legacy. Actually, I want to begin at the end of chapter 49. If we start just a few verses before, in Genesis chapter 49 and verse 29, we read about his father, Jacob. Then Jacob gave these instructions: I'm about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave of the field of Ephron the Hittite, the cave in the field of M, near M in Cana, which Abraham brought as a burial place from Ephron the Hittite, along with the field. Verse 31, there Abraham and his wife Sarah were buried, there Isaac and his wife Rebekah were buried, and there I buried Leah. The field and the cave in it were brought from the Hittites. Verse 33, when Jacob had finished giving instructions to his sons, he drew his feet up into his bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. Now we're at Genesis chapter 50, verse 1. Joseph threw himself upon his father and wept over him and kissed him. Then Joseph directed the physicians in his service to embalm his father Israel, or Jacob. And so the physicians embalmed him, taking a full 40 days, for that was the time required for embalming. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. So here we have Father Jacob has died, and he is buried according to the Egyptian customs, which shows the wealth of Joseph. We know that Egyptian burial was a very long and lengthy and expensive and involved process. The internal organs are removed and the brain is removed from the nose and an embalming fluid is added in. It says in verse 3, did you catch this? The Egyptians mourned his death for 70 days. When a pharaoh died, the people all had to mourn for 72 days. So this is showing again the status and the power and the wealth and the prestige of Joseph. Just a few days less than when a pharaoh would die. Continue on, look at verse 4. And when the days of mourning had passed, Joseph said to Pharaoh's court, if I have found favor in your eyes, speak to Pharaoh for me. Tell him, my father made me swear an oath and said, I'm about to die. Bury me in the tomb I have dug for myself in the land of Canaan. Now let me go and bury my father, then I will return. Verse 6, Pharaoh says, go and bury your father. And he made you, as he made you swear to do. So Joseph went up to bury his father. All of Pharaoh's officials accompanied him, the dignitaries of the court and all the dignitaries of Egypt, and beside all the members of Joseph's household and his brothers and all those belonging to his father's household. Only the children and their flocks and herds were left in Goshen. Chariots and horsemen also went up with him. It was a very large company. Verse 10, when they reached the threshing floor of Atad near the Jordan, they lamented loudly and bitterly, and there Joseph observed a seven-day period of mourning for his father. When the Canaanites who lived there saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, the Egyptians are holding a solemn ceremony of mourning. And that is why the place near the Jordan is called Abel Mizraim. So Jacob's sons did as he commanded them. They carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of M, near M, that's what we call it, which Abraham had brought as a burial place from Ephron the Hittite along with the field. Verse 14, after burying his father, Joseph returned to Egypt together with his brothers and all the others who had gone with him to bury their father. So they carry Jacob out. They bury him at a place called Abel Mizraim, which means the mourning of Egypt. Now their father had just died. So now it's Joseph and his 11 brothers. And all of a sudden, Joseph and his 11 brothers are in a brand new situation. Many of us have been in this situation where one of our parents or both of our parents have died. And something changes in our life when our parents die. That safety net, or at least that safety net that we assume is there, is now gone. Sometimes it opens old wounds. Sometimes we feel alone, even though we maybe really weren't alone, or we start to realize now that we ourselves are getting a little older. All those things are happening here. And with Joseph and his brothers, all is not well. The brothers are afraid that Joseph now is going to retaliate against them. Keep in mind that Father Jacob loved his son Joseph more than any of the other children and showed that favoritism to Joseph. With that in mind, now we'll read the final section here. Look at verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him? Verse 16. So they sent word to Joseph saying, Hey, your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of your servants of the God of your father. When their message came to him, Joseph wept. Verse 18. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before Joseph. "We are your slaves," they said. But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. Ah, so do you see what the brothers are doing here? They claim they're honest men. Hey, we're honest men. We're not spies. We're just showing up in Egypt looking for food. We're really good people, right? But they hatched this plot. And so they sent this message to Joseph. "Hey, Joe, right before Pops died, he said that whatever you do, make sure that you totally forgive all of us," right? It's clear that they are afraid. They're lying. They're being deceitful. They are not honest people. In these verses we read, 18, 19, and 20, there's something fascinating in each one of these verses that I find very interesting. Here we are in verse 18. They threw themselves down before him. Which brings us now full circle, right, to 85 years earlier when Joseph had those dreams of the family bowing down to him. And here they are finally bowing down to him. God brings forth his plans. God will conclude what he starts, right? So that's something that's interesting in 18. But notice 19. "Don't be afraid," Joseph says. "Am I in the place of God? Hey, I'm not God. I'm not the one who brings justice and punishment. That's God's role." Joseph clearly here has an understanding of who God is and who he himself is. It's not my job to bring revenge. It's not my job to bring justice. That is God's job. I'm just one of his servants. What's interesting about this phrase, "I am not God," is that it kind of bookends the very beginning of the book of Genesis. Because at the very beginning of the book of Genesis, what do we have? We have two people who are trying to be like God, right? Adam and Eve. Hey, we can do whatever we want. And here at the very end of Genesis, we have someone claiming, no, I am not God. God is God, and I am just a human being. It's just a fascinating little conclusion here from the very beginning to the very end of the book of Genesis. Notice in verse 20, if there's a verse you can highlight in your Bible, if there's a verse you can underline or make bold in your electronic versions, it's verse 20. "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good." Not only is this the key message of the story of Joseph, but really this is the key message of the story of the entire book of Genesis. Whatever evil happens to us, God can redeem it for good. This is a powerful lesson. This is what is found time and time again in the book of Genesis. In fact, this is a theme that's woven through the entire Bible. The greatest harm known to man, Jesus dying on the cross, God can take that and turn it into the greatest thing possible, our freedom and our redemption. This is a powerful truth that is found here. This means that forgiveness will always win over evil. Love will always triumph over vengeance. Sacrifice will always win over death. All of those things also point us to Jesus, right? Who has taken the greatest evil upon himself, and God has been able to use it for good. Joseph says, "You intended it for evil, but God intends it for good." It's a great truth for us in our faith that whatever evil comes our way, that God has the power and the ability to take the worst of it and fold it into his great and powerful plan for us. Look at verse 22. We conclude with this. Joseph stayed in Egypt along with all his father's family. He lived 110 years and saw the third generation of Ephraim's children. Also the children of Machir, son of Manasseh, were placed at birth on Joseph's knees. He's seen all of his grandkids. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land, as he promised an oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." Joseph made the sons of Israel, his father, swear an oath and said, "God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up from this place." And Joseph died at the age of 110. And after that, they embalmed him. He was placed in a coffin in Egypt. Joseph died and was buried. Today, his burial site is known. It's considered to be in what's called modern-day Palestine. The story of Joseph is actually held in high regard by both Muslims and Christians. You can read the Quran, and the Quran's account of the book of Joseph and what Joseph has done is very similar to the account that we have in our Bible. It was just last year, you can jump on Google News and see that the tomb site of Joseph was bombed and there was some arson that occurred over what was considered the tomb site. And this ends the amazing adventures of Joseph. But think of our man Joseph. I mean, here we are, right? 4,000 years later. We name our children after him. We study about him. We learn. We grow closer to God because of this man and his powerful legacy. I mean, he had that chaos of his crazy family. He stood tall against temptation. He waited for those 12 years in trusting in God, even when his circumstances were against it. He survived success. He showed how you can have powerful forgiveness to a family who wronged him. And today we're ending by seeing how Joseph calls out to us, don't just live your life, but really live your legacy. Now draw this home to us, right? Martin Luther, the great German priest from 500 years ago, he was asked, what would you do if you were going to die tomorrow? What would you do today? And Martin Luther's response was, I go and I plant a tree, okay? Which means, in other words, he would want to leave behind a legacy of life that would grow on and on and on into the future. And this is what I think we want. We want to leave a legacy that will shape others for generations to come. So how do we not just live our lives, but live our legacy? Well, 2,000 years after Joseph was the guy, the Apostle Paul. Paul, who spent the first half of his life killing followers of Jesus, had that face-to-face encounter with Jesus, had that total change of his life, and then spent the remainder of his life telling others about this Jesus, traveling over the Middle East and to Europe and starting all these brand new churches. At the end of Paul's life, Paul writes a letter to the young pastor Timothy. And in 2 Timothy chapter 4, you see it behind me, I have fought the good fight, he says, I have finished the race, and I have remained faithful. Here's a man like Joseph who had tremendous amount of accomplishments in his life. He could have talked about the fact that he traveled thousands of miles for Jesus. He could have talked about all the dozens of churches that he started. And he could have talked about all the people that he led to Jesus. He could have talked about how he had this great PhD in theology and how he wrote most of what we call the New Testament. Instead, he says, this is what I want to pass on. This is that legacy. And we can take these three, we can take this sentence here and break it down into these different phrases as we see them, right? He first says, I need you to fight the good fight. Each day when we awake, we are reminded that we are in a war. The enemies are not the other political party that we dislike. The enemies are not some other religion that we dislike. The enemies are not some people that hate us. The enemy is the evil that drives them. And so we are at war, and we fight this war with love, with sacrifice, with grace, with kindness, with compassion towards the least of these. We have daily choices that we have to make every single moment. Daily choices with my anger, with my money, with my jobs, with my relationships. It sounds kind of weird to think about the fact that we're in a war. I mean, we're up north, we live in the suburbs, everything is wonderful and great, and it's all fine around us. We have the freedom to escape to, you know, to Fort Wilderness. But when we get casual in talking about spiritual things, this begins to threaten us, and it threatens our legacy. And when this happens, the legacy that we do leave behind is weak, and it's shallow, and it's superficial. I think Joseph is calling out to us, don't just live your life, live your legacy. Choose every single day to fight the good fight, to fight for God. He continues on there in that middle phrase. He talks about finishing the race. We probably all know somebody that started out on fire for the Lord, and then something happened to them. Just generally drifted. Just over time, they began to lose hope or they began to give up. And maybe that's many of our stories. I know it's many of the stories of the people that come to our church that were in church at some point in their life and they've been out of it for 20, 30 years, and now finally they're slowly coming back around. Right or wrong, we've all been there where maybe we just kind of drift away and we're coming back now to understand who this God is. When Paul writes to Timothy 2,000 years ago, he says, I have finished the race. He's talking about his own faithfulness, his own consistency. And he uses that running analogy to talk about his life. Okay, so just 2 years ago, I started running for the first time. And I know when you look at me, you're saying, there's no way in the world you're a runner. Hey, if Forrest Gump can do it, right? That's what I say. I can do it. Over the last 24 months, I've done 7 half marathons and 2 full marathons. And I've learned that running takes discipline, right? It takes focus. It takes determination. And it also takes other people yelling at you, encouraging you, giving you, you can do it and hang in there. With all those long races, when you do a full marathon or even more than that, There's always that place where you hit the wall, right? We hear about hitting the wall. And for me, I read about it. I talked with people. And for me, it was at mile 20. And at mile 20, your body just shuts down. It just literally says to yourself, you cannot take another step. And you know you've got another 6 miles. You know you've got another hour ahead of you. And you want to give up and you can't do it anymore. And you fight through it and you focus. And it's just literally one step in front of the other. One of the greatest feelings you have in your life, right, is crossing that finish line, and you're crying and ready. I mean, just everything is going on. It's every emotion known to man is right there. And a lot, in a similar way, running is a lot like following Jesus, right? It takes focus, takes discipline, takes determination. It takes other people coming alongside of you and yelling at you and encouraging you and supporting you and challenging you and telling you you can do it and just take one step in front of the other. And I've been there and I've gone through that. And if I can do it, then so can you as well. If we're going to just not just live our life but live our legacy, then we also have to fight the good fight and we have to finish the race. And that last phrase there is a real powerful one. Paul says we have to remain faithful. That word remain means to manage, to guard, to look over, to hold on to the truth of God's love for us. It means that we need to pursue God daily. It's not just a Sunday morning experience. It's not just when we're at camp for that week. It's this. It's when your coworkers look at you, when your coworkers look at what you do, what you joke about, what you say, when your coworkers look at your character, do they see Jesus? Or do they see something else? That's what it means to remain faithful. Think about that. When your family looks at you, what you watch, how you spend your money, what you complain about, do they see Jesus or do they see something else? When your friends look at your life, is there something more there that's pointing them to God or is it just, you know, being a nice person around them? Remaining faithful means regardless of the circumstances, we draw close to God. Think about all those hardships that Joseph went through, abandoned in prison, waiting on God. And he still drew close to God. He kept the faith. Why is this important? It's so important for us because when we see people who get to the end of their life who are remaining faithful, it inspires the rest of us. It gives us hope, right? If she can do it, then so can I. And if he can do it, then so can I. Others around us are looking to see about our life. And when your life is going through that chaos, they're watching you to see, how are you going to be? How are you going to handle that chaos that you go through in your life? Are you going to break or are you going to lean closer to God? And when we lean closer to God, it sends a powerful message to our friends around us here. I am telling us here, I don't want us to just live our life. I want us to live our legacy now. And so look at the legacy of our man Joseph. I mean, we've been with him just 5 days, right? But 4,000 years later, his life inspires us. It gives us hope and encouragement. His life points to the God who is personal and active and loving and who cares for every single one of us. Joseph's story tells us that regardless of how many mistakes we've made in our life, regardless of how many broken relationships we've had, regardless of the struggles or the hardships that we've experienced, that we have a God who is greater than all of these things. And we can start now when we commit ourselves to him. And this begins our legacy with Jesus, with God. And so to each of us, this is how we live a godly legacy. We fight the good fight, we finish the race, and we remain faithful. Let me give us a prayer of dedication for all of us as we conclude our time here this morning. Lord, it's a challenge when we dig into your word because it convicts, it inspires, it encourages. Sometimes, Lord, it cuts to us. Lord, I'm so thankful for the lessons that we see in Joseph when he teaches us about forgiveness. Lord, you know how so many of us wrestle with the hurts of other people, wrestle with how do we move past some of these great wounds that we carry. Lord, we know that we are commanded to forgive, and I am so thankful, Lord, that we have a God who models that in forgiving us. And Lord, just as Jesus has forgiven us, may we reflect that same forgiveness to those people who have hurt us. May we, Lord, be set free by the forgiveness that we extend to other people. And Lord, when we think of our man Joseph, when we think of the legacy that he lives, we are so thankful for this real life example, for his ability to withstand temptation, for his ability to come through a chaotic family life. Lord, we're so thankful that he drew close to you in that time of waiting and he was able to survive success, Lord, in a way that is honoring and pleasing to you. Help us to follow his example. Lord, we are so thankful that he points his life to you, and may we draw closer to you as well. Help us, Lord, to fight the good fight. Help us, Lord, to finish the race strong. Help us, Lord, to remain faithful regardless of the circumstances that we are going through. Lord, may you empower us with your Spirit as we live our lives, as we continue on, and as we leave tomorrow. And we ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen.